It's the First Amendment, broadband style.
It's a safe, well-engineered, perfectly designed machine.
TalkZone.com. Internet talk radio.
TalkZone.com.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Hi, I'm Hub Arkush, along with Jim Clemens and Mike Wilkening, and it's our pleasure to welcome you to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. We've got the new NBA champs and all the news scoops and rumors before they happen.
And loads of NBA news, plus updates on NFL contract squabbles.
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.
Welcome to this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. I'm Hub Arkush, along with my co-host, Jim Clemens of the L.A. Lakers, and our senior editor here at Pro Football Weekly, Mike Wilkening. We will also be joined in the show by Steve Kyler of HoopsWorld.com. But right now, we kick it off with one of the assistant coaches of the world champion Los Angeles Lakers. They win back-to-back titles, first repeat since they did it in 2001 and 2002. And, you know, Jimmy, obviously a very hard-fought series. In the end, what did you see? What was really the difference between your Lakers and the Celtics?
Well, Hub, I think ultimately it was the energy that we found, the heart, the will, the desire to come back to Los Angeles and play well. I thought the games in Boston last week, we obviously played better in game three, but games four and five, give Boston credit. They just outplayed us. They out-hustled us. And those were the plays ultimately that caused our demise in two of the three games in Boston. But we came home more dedicated. I think the crowd and the magnitude of the situation, I would say desperation, because we knew it's the first one of four. They had three, so we had to win our two games back here.
You know, Mike, at times I felt like I was watching more of a football game than a basketball game. I don't think I've ever seen two teams play better defense, better team defense, and the officials really allowed them to play. It really got physical for the entire ball game.
Yeah, and I think on many levels, great basketball defense is just beautiful to watch. And when you saw the way that Boston defended. You saw the way the Lakers defended. I mean, the Lakers shot 32.5% in a Game 7 winning effort. There was some beauty in the ruggedness of this. Obviously, the Lakers, I think, were able to adapt a little bit better, were able to get the line more, and that was the key. But for a defensive aficionado, Game 7 was something really to behold. Those were two teams laying it on the line defensively, and I know it was a low final score, but again, I think there's beauty in that to me, Hub.
Well, and Mike, you know, it was interesting because the officials allowed them to play. There was a real disparity in the free throws, particularly in the fourth quarter and the second half. That's the only way the Lakers come back from that 13-point deficit. And if the Lakers had hit more free throws, this thing wouldn't have been all that close. Late in the third and early in the fourth, they were struggling from the line. And yet, from the Celtics' perspective, this game was absolutely there for them. They couldn't find anybody to hit a key bucket in the last 6-7 minutes. Ray Allen came up with a two at about the 6-minute mark, and then he hit a desperation three. Rasheed Wallace hit the 1-3 late. But the bottom line is that the Lakers were able to find more players to help out Kobe Bryant, and the Celtics just didn't have an answer to find points.
Right, and I think that's something that they're going to have to look at, you know, in the off season in terms of, you know, maybe, you know, getting another scorer in the mix. Look, that Celtics bench was, you know, very, very good, you know, earlier in the series. You know, certainly, there are some elements here to make another run, but you're right, Hub. I mean, this was a team that struggled to score it. Ray Allen, as we know, you know, as the series went on, really, you know, the shot wasn't quite there. It's 3 of 14 in game 7. So yes, the lack of scoring kind of hurt them. And, you know, all things considered, though, again, you've got to give the Lakers a lot of credit. They played good defense. And I think that defense put them in position to help them win this title.
Yeah, I'm giving Jimmy a little bit of a pass here, not asking you to comment, Jim, too much on a game you were so intimately involved in. I want to get back to you with another question in a second. But, Mike, just another thought from you. I'm watching the post game, and clearly Ron Artest, if not the difference, was a key contributor in this ball game. And yet the people that he wanted to thank in the post game interview were his psychiatrist, his other doctors. It's a strange situation to see Ron Artest in such a pivotal role, and yet you cannot ignore how pivotal that role was.
Right. What obviously stands out, that big three-pointer near the end, giving them the six-point lead. You know, overall, 7 of 18 from the floor, 2 of 7 from 3. If they lost, you know, obviously, you know, certainly that was a lot of shots he took, but he's got the confidence, obviously, to keep firing. We've seen that time and again. He's never lacked for that. Was an integral part of this championship team. And 20 points when his team really, really needed it most. Yeah, he fit in with this group, I think, and it worked out well. And, you know, to play like he did in 46 minutes of the biggest game of his career, certainly, you know, tip of the cap to him.
Steve Kuyler of HoopsWorld.com is with us as well. And Steve, your general impressions, Jimmy told us the difference was intensity. Certainly it was defense. In your mind, what was the difference in that ball game, that game seven between the Celtics and the Lakers?
Well, guys, I really think that it boils down to team effort. You know, Kobe did not shoot the ball well, and you know, the other guys kind of stepped up. You saw Ron Artest hit big shots. You saw Lamar Odom play big, and Pau Gasol showed up, despite the fact that really as a team they shot free throws poorly, they shot the ball poorly. They just really hung in there together. And I think the one thing that really kind of showed up on the Celtics side was, and I think Doc Rivers said the best, in the fourth quarter, they just looked really old.
Steve, I heard a number of references from the broadcasters about what a well-officiated game it was, and I think it was, and they allowed them to play. But I started at the top by saying I didn't know sometimes if I was watching football or basketball.
Oh, it was absolutely a physical game. And, you know, the one thing in you talk to people in officiating circles, they don't want to be the guys that decide games. They just don't, especially when it's things like a championship or a game seven or a game that matters in terms of advancing. The officials want to make sure that it's called fairly, the things that are obviously fouls are fouls. And I think if you look at it, and, you know, credit Jeff Van Gundy, because I think he's been probably one of the most critical of officiating as a broadcaster. You know, he was dead on. Most of the things that were whistled last night were very good calls, very astute calls. And I think the thing that you saw more than anything was the officials were going to let the players decide this. It wasn't going to be the whistle.
So, Jimmy, most guys go a career and don't get a ring. You've got 10. I got to ask you, how do you explain that?
Well, I've been extremely blessed in the fact that I've been around good basketball. From the day I first started playing the game, I've had outstanding coaches and teachers and been around fantastic athletes who have wanted to become better basketball players. And I understand there are a lot of ways to do things, but the system in which we teach and how we have gotten players from various backgrounds to join together for one goal, which is to, you know, put their personal opinions aside and become better teammates. And when you do that, good things happen. It's been said basketball is a sport that brings various individuals together, but it's about wanting to win and doing your best. If you do your best, people, regardless of who gets the credit, there's nothing like winning. And that's what championships are about.
All right, gentlemen, the L.A. Lakers world champs once again. We need to take a quick break. Lots of NBA way we hear it. We'll talk about Tom Izzo and the Cavs next. Welcome back. Hub Arkish, Mike Wilkening, and Jimmy Clemens bringing you this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. And we are joined, as we are every week, by our very favorite NBA and college hoops insider, Steve Kuyler of HoopsWorld.com, for the very best in basketball news. You've got to get to HoopsWorld.com. And, Steve, I want to start this segment with you. Tom Izzo is staying in East Lansing. Now, the longer he debated over the Cavaliers and the Spartans, a lot of people believed he might be heading to the NBA, and yet in the end, the perception is his inability to even reach LeBron James, let alone talk to him about what James might be doing in free agency, was the final nail in the coffin for the Cavs.
Yeah, but it was a little bigger than that, too, Hub. You know, Tom had really reached out to a lot of people in the NBA to try to, you know, get an understanding, was he going to be the right guy at the NBA level? Could he have success? You know, there's a long history of college coaches just not being able to get it done at the pro level, and I think that weighed into it as well. But, you know, there's just such an uncertainty with LeBron, and LeBron has really kind of taken a hands-off approach at every level to what's going on with the Cleveland Cavaliers. I think that probably threw up a really big red flag that's hard to get past. When he won't even return the phone call of the owner, I think you've got bigger issues. And I think that ultimately, you know, he has such a sweetheart deal at Michigan State. I think that very much like Coach Krzyzewski at Duke, he'll have that job as long as he wants it. I don't think that there's any scenario other than, you know, significant scandal that would have him ever fired from that job. And I think all of us would love to have lifelong security, especially in the coaching profession. And it just seemed like there was too good a situation in Michigan, at Michigan State, for Tom Izzo. And I think the uncertainties across the board for Cleveland ultimately was their undoing.
You know, Jim, this is a fascinating situation in many respects, because LeBron James seems determined to make it clear he's not trying to pick his own head coach in Cleveland, that he's not going to meddle in the process. And yet in doing that, he's really harming the franchise, because as Steve just pointed out, and I think you would agree, who's going to go there if they don't know whether LeBron's going to be there or not?
Well, I think in actuality, from my vantage point, if all the cards are on the board, then LeBron's doing exactly what he should be doing. I mean, if he doesn't know if he's coming back, then why should he give them any inclination that he may be coming back? Because they picked the coach because he says he's coming back, he didn't come back, then they're going to say he lied or he misled them. So I think Cleveland has to do what they need to do as a franchise, because he's already stated he's going to see what his options are. That doesn't rule out he's not going back to Cleveland, but I don't think he wants to send them mixed messages, and then ultimately if he doesn't, then they can say he misled them. So I think he's being straight with them.
Well, and Mike, in keeping with what Jimmy just said, the reports out of Cleveland now are that they may just have to wait until after July 1st and as long after as it takes for LeBron James to make a decision before they hire a head coach.
Right, and some of the focus has turned to whether or not Byron Scott might be the favorite for that job, but it would not be a surprise, Hub, if they did wait, and may make the most sense, to be honest. I don't know if there's necessarily a rush at this point to get something done. Clearly, Izzo was their top target. That did not work out, and now, from the Cleveland standpoint, you can take a little bit of time here. Get through the draft, certainly get through free agency, and then maybe make the move. No need to rush, and I would tend to think that really when it comes down to it, obviously the biggest issue this offseason for them is whether or not they sign LeBron. After that, the dominoes, I think, fall where they may.
All right, so Steve, I'm going to side with Jim and say let's give LeBron the benefit of the doubt that he's doing the right thing here, that he's doing the only thing he can do. Does he end up harming himself if he decides to stay in Cleveland and then it's the middle of July and all the top head coaching candidates have already gone elsewhere?
You know, Hub, that's something we've been discussing quite a bit is who's really out there. You know, beyond Byron Scott, you know, who's the guy that wins a championship next year? There are a lot of great coaches, a lot of great assistant coaches, but, you know, who's the guy with the championship pedigree? Unless Phil Jackson opts to leave the L.A. Lakers, I'm not sure that there's anybody out there. And, you know, the thing with Byron Scott is he wants to wait and make sure he doesn't miss out on an opportunity to be a Laker head coach. But at the same time, I think it's ultimately going to be Byron Scott, or it's going to be an assistant. And I think that's really about, does LeBron stay? If LeBron is not staying, you can certainly take a shot at giving Chris Gent the job or going out and giving a Lawrence Frank another shot. But, you know, if you're going to keep LeBron James, you've got to bring in a coach that matters. And I think the only one that's left is really probably Byron Scott.
Jim, I'm sure that Phil and everybody on your staff did everything they could to let it not be a factor. But was there at any point during the playoffs where this uncertainty of what Phil's going to do was even something that was, well, people admitted that it was there, you know, even though I'm sure you weren't sitting around talking about it and worrying about it?
Well, we've been through this scenario the last few years, and he's on a year-to-year contract. We know that going in. So we're at the same abyss as we were last year, and you can't worry about it. We've been extremely fortunate to do well out here. I think, you know, all feelers are our head coach, but if he decides not to come back, then we'll be scurrying looking for jobs, and if he comes back, hopefully we will be retained. But the fact is, sooner or later, owners and general managers have to realize there are a lot of good coaches in this league, and if you're going to wait for your choice, then they're going to miss out on a lot of outstanding basketball minds that can move a team forward.
All right, guys, let's take a quick commercial break here and then talk about a little bit of a surprise in the Valley of the Sun as there will be change in Phoenix this offseason. We continue with our NBA way we hear it. We'll talk a little bit of NBA draft in this segment as well. But first, Jimmy, Steve Kerr is leaving the Phoenix Suns, and he has gone to a great deal of trouble to convince us all that this was absolutely his choice, that there was no issues between he and owner Robert Sarver about his contract. You know, just a couple weeks ago, there were some questions about whether the negotiation would get acrimonious. Now suddenly Steve has said it's a family decision. His boys are teenagers. He wants to spend the last couple years while they're in the house with them. And yet still, this kind of came out of nowhere.
I saw Steve a couple of times during our playoff run, and from our Chicago days, obviously we have a relationship, and he did mention the fact that his oldest son is a senior this year, and he wanted to be around more. So I don't know if it was a prelude to this, or he's just being completely honest, and people think there's always an ulterior motive, but Steve is a very family-oriented man, and I can see him wanting to be more involved, or at least through the experience of his son's senior year in high school, because he doesn't know where he's going to go off to college. So it makes sense to me, and I read nothing more into it other than that, and let's hope, once again, Steve's been a very stand-up guy, so I take him at his word.
Let me ask our Steve Kyler. Steve Kerr's done a pretty good job with this ball club. They look to be in trouble even just a year ago, and yet the hiring of Alvin Gentry has worked out well, the trade for Jason Richardson, Amari Stoudemire has come back to be an all-star. I guess the big question is, will they retain Amari Stoudemire? He's obviously going to get the max contract he wants somewhere. It would be more if he stayed in Phoenix. There have been some hurt feelings there the last couple of years, but if they get Stoudemire back, Kerr's leaving this ball club in pretty good shape.
Yeah, Steve Kerr's done a great job, but this really, isn't a huge surprise. Steve Kerr was kind of a reluctant hire here. You know, when Robert Sarver bought the team, Steve was kind of his friend and advisor. They shared a lot of basketball over some beers, and ultimately when things went bad with Mike D'Antoni, he kind of pleaded with Steve to come and help him out and to take the job. And, Steve had never been very comfortable in this role. He was great with the media, but you could almost sense that it was just an uncomfortable kind of situation. And really, last year there was talk that this could be Kerr's last go of it, and that he was trying to convince Robert Sarver to turn the team over to assistant GM David Griffin. So, this really isn't huge news. I mean, kind of surprising considering how the Suns had fared this season. But I think the bigger news is the fact that David Griffin has also announced he's not staying with the team because he's not a candidate to replace Steve Kerr. So not only is it they're losing Steve Kerr, they're really losing, probably the architect of that roster construction in David Griffin, who's been with the team for 18 years. That's a lot of leadership, a lot of direction that's going to change. And in talking with Amari Stoudemire's camp, that's the thing they're most concerned about. Where is this team going in the future? That's what Amari wants to understand before he's going to commit to any. Anybody. His heart is in Phoenix, but the Phoenix Suns are doing a lot of things that show they may not have a very clear direction right now.
Well, and the follow-up question to that, Steve, is that even though, again, there has been some acrimony between Stoudemire and the ball club and their refusal to renegotiate his contract sooner, Steve Kerr is so well-liked and so popular, and now with complete turnover in the front office, does that almost help to push Amari out the door a little bit?
Absolutely, it does. I mean, it certainly removes any real loyalty. There was loyalty to Steve Kerr because Steve Kerr did stand by Amari when he had that really nasty knee injury, that really nasty eye injury last year. There was a lot of faith put in Amari, and ultimately he didn't trade Amari. There were a lot of opportunities where he could have sent Amari to a number of different places. He kept him in Phoenix, and they had some success. And, Amari is very close with Steve Kerr, and there's a lot of personal connections that get built there. And I think when you don't have any more friends in the organization that way, it's a whole lot easier to say it's just business, and we're going to look at this strictly from a business point of view. I think now it's on Robert Sarver to create an environment that says this is going to be better business for Amari. If not, I think there's a very good chance he's going to leave.
Jimmy, very strange situation in Portland where GM Kevin Pritchard hasn't been fired, and yet he has told a local newspaper that he knows owner Paul Allen has retained a search firm to seek candidates for his replacement. Now, you know, we see more and more of this in pro sports these days, and it's the owner's team. They can do what they want. They pay the big bucks. But just seems like a strange way to run a business. And you have to wonder, by Pritchard doing something like this, is he trying to force his own firing so that he can get out there and look for another job somewhere else?
It's strange when we talk about ownership, general managers, and coaches in our teams. They now, and I'm jumping on the other side of the fence, guys. They talk about how much of a family we are, and sometimes you wonder, well, whose family are you talking about? Because obviously sometimes we all feel like we're stepchildren, and we're not biological children, and we're not part of the family, because the decisions that are being made certainly don't promote togetherness and foster the unity that owners and general managers like to send out to the public. So they need to get it straight, and you're either with us or you're not with us, and that's fine. Because ultimately, I think players and coaches alike understand it is a business. So don't talk about family out one side of your mouth and then talk about, like, business on the other. And sure, there's a gray line in there, but the fact remains, when times get tough, we know which way whose side they are on. And that's the problem, because it destroys the trust and the relationships that you build to show people that, right, you are doing the right thing. You do want the right things for your club and those who are employed by you. But the bottom line is, and we all know it, they are going to treat it like a business, and that's why there's so much distrust in this profession.
Hey, Steve, before we switch to football, I gave a quick tease on the draft. We'll cover it in depth next week, but HoopsWorld.com has its mock draft up now. Again, go to HoopsWorld.com to check it out. Your top five, John Wall to the Wizards, Evan Turner to the Sixers, Derek Favors coming off third to the Nets, Wesley Johnson at four to the Timberwolves, and Patrick Patterson from Kentucky going to the Kings at number five. That's a bit of a surprise to me. Patterson at number five. Any other surprises, any big trade rumors you're hearing right now?
Well, the top five is going to change, Hub. I was actually working on that just before we got together. You're probably going to see Greg Monroe going number five to the Sacramento Kings, with DeMarcus Cousins going no lower than number six. The real big trade rumor right now involves that number five pick. What did the Sacramento Kings do? The word is the Detroit Pistons desperately would like to move up. They've got eyes for DeMarcus Cousins. They'd love to add his big body to what they're doing. They're willing to give up the number seven pick. There's word they may even be willing to part with Tayshaun Prince to help make a deal happen. So that's really the one there at the top of the draft to keep an eye on. You know, Sacramento had DeMarcus Cousins in for a very good workout. They had Derek Favors in as well. But it does seem like, kind of from the beginning, the Jeff Petries really liked Greg Monroe from Georgetown, and it looks like that's probably going to be their guy. Now, whether that happens at five or ultimately at number seven because of a deal kind of remains to be seen, but it does look like the number five's in play.
We will go in depth on that next week. We say goodbye to Steve Kyler for now and to Jimmy Clemens. They will be back as we do more NBA draft coverage next week. Right now, we get ready for NFL, the way we hear it. Hub Arkush and Mike Wilkening back in studio as we kick off our NFL portion of the show, and we welcome in executive editor Dan Arkush. And you know, Dan, not that much happening with the Seattle Seahawks, but all kinds of things happening with Pete Carroll in light of the 2-year bowl probation handed down to USC. It all happened under Pete Carroll's watch. He had two choices. He could just kind of stay silent and let it go away and wash his hands of it, or he could be very vocal. And he has chosen to be extremely vocal and started attacking the NCAA, insisting that he wasn't aware of any of it. And you just wonder if it's having any impact on the Seahawks.
Well, Hub, you're exactly right. I mean, the other day he basically told the media, bring it on. Let's get this all out of the way. I mean, and he maintains that, you know, he really had no control over any of this. Basically, he's more concerned about the Seahawks. You know, obviously, a lot of people thought when he took the job that he might have been taking it to escape this whole USC scenario, but he insists that that's not the case. And as far as the, any kind of a carryover effect on the team, the people we talk to seem to think that it, that basically, you know, it, it's a very positive situation in spite of this kind of background music. Very competitive. I mean, everybody but anybody is getting a chance to make this team, and so basically it's a pretty upbeat deal there.
The interesting thing to me, Dan, is obviously I can't comment on Pete Carroll's motivations for leaving college football and coming back to the NFL at this time. But I don't think anybody believes that he had no control over what happened at USC. And it's almost like the more he talks about it, while it may not impact the Seahawks, the more of a comic book character he kind of becomes to some folks.
Yeah, you know, you do get that perception. But, you know, he, to his credit, I mean, he is facing it head on and talking about it. I don't know, maybe it's his way of kind of getting it out of his system. But there are changes that are being made on the national scale. You don't hear a lot about them, but people like Red Bryant is suddenly got a big chance to be an outside force as a pass rusher, and Lawyer Malloy has won back the safety job, and there's an open competition going on day in and day out, and so in that regard, the Seahawks are cooking.
All right, Dan, thank you very much. We now bring in senior editor Eric Edholm. We go coast to coast to another Washington, this time D.C., and I'll bet the Redskins would like to have the Seahawks problems right now, wouldn't they, Eric?
Yeah, well, congratulations, Albert Hainsworth. You've replaced Ben Roethlisberger as the offseason villain right now, at least. But, yeah, I mean, obviously the situation with Hainsworth having taken a $21 million bonus check, $21 million on April 1st, having been allowed to work out a trade before that date, nothing happened. They paid him the check. They expected him to be there. Well, guess what? He hasn't shown up to mini camps, probably doesn't plan to show up at training camp. Players are speaking out, Hub. They're calling him selfish. They're saying he turns back on him. And you have to think on a certain level, he absolutely did.
There is nothing defensible about what Albert Hainsworth is doing here. I mean, you know, he's taken the $21 million check in April, $26 million collected so far, $41 million guaranteed on the contract, played 1 year, gave him 4.5 sacks, and didn't show up every week when he did play last year in terms of giving, you know, a great performance. And now, what? There's no basis on which he has anything to complain about. I mean, teams switch defenses. You know, he took the money, and you would think that there would be a way, if the Redskins pursue a grievance, for them to get some of this money back if he now refuses to perform.
Yeah, there's a real precedent for this, actually, Hub. You know, you look at Bruce Allen, who's the general manager now, and I know Mike Shanahan obviously is going to have a lot to do with this. Daniel Snyder will certainly get involved, but they're asking for $26 million back. Well, Allen previously, when he was in Tampa Bay, got money back from Keenan McCardle, who, guess what, is the wide receivers coach for the Redskins. So they know firsthand that this can happen. Now, obviously, this is on a larger scale, highest paid defensive player of all time, and yet he's not happy. So I think there is something here. You know, some people think there's only a slim chance based on the collective bargaining agreement that they could get something back. But some other people really feel strongly they've got a case here and that they should be able to do something before a trade or a release is worked out.
All right, Eric, thank you very much. We're going to take a quick break here. We've got more NFL Way We Hear It coming up. We'll talk Miami Dolphins, New Orleans Saints, and a few other clubs right after this. We continue our NFL Way We Hear It here on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News, and we're joined now by Associate Editor Dan Parr. And Dan, one of your clubs, the Miami Dolphins, and it seems like the story with so many of these teams now are getting tender offers signed on their restricted free agents, a lot of them guys who wouldn't have been restricted had this not been an uncapped year and had we not been in this collective bargaining impasse that the league and the players are in right now. Ronnie Brown has not yet signed his tender offer, but it's already the lowest it can be. It's 110% increase over his 09 salary. He's going to get $3.97 million. Brown wants a long-term deal, almost certainly won't get one. He's a 28-year-old running back who's had a serious knee injury. The Dolphins want him back for this year, don't know after that, but there's no real incentive for Brown to sign the tender offer fast because they can't really lower it on him.
That's right. Unlike other restricted free agents who faced that deadline on June 15th, Ronnie Brown did not have to worry about having his salary reduced. That already was 100%, as you said, 110% of his salary from 2009. So Ronnie Brown is a guy who has had a pretty solid career, especially when he's healthy. But he's getting up there in age. The Dolphins aren't, you know, going to be inclined to offer a long-term deal to a running back that's coming off a Lisfranc injury, had to undergo surgery. Brown has, in two of the past 3 years, has suffered, you know, serious injuries that have kept him sidelined. If the Dolphins like what they see from him in 2010, they could always put the franchise tag on him next season. So they have options there. They don't need to rush in and offer him a long-term deal. That's just not going to happen.
Well, and so much of this also, Dan, is because some of these teams, they don't know what the collective bargaining landscape is going to look like a year from now, and they are trying to avoid long-term deals wherever they can.
That's right. We don't know what's going to happen, if there's going to be a season, or how much of a season there will be in 2011. And the Dolphins are, they, you know, I've talked to sources who said they really don't think they should be paying a running back more than $4 million a year. So, you know, Ronnie Brown, depending on what his asking price is, and I'm sure it's pretty high at this point, he's looking to cash in while he can. The Dolphins just aren't going to budge.
Well, Dan, in New Orleans, another one of the teams you cover, Pierre Thomas has signed his tender, certainly a very productive back in his own right. What's his outlook on getting a long-term deal done with the Saints?
I think it's still possible that they could work something out, but Thomas is going to have to lower that asking price. He signed his tender this week and said that, you know, he still will be probably holding out of voluntary activities. He's not going to hold out of mandatory things and face hefty fines. He's not going to go that route. The Saints do see him as a block for the future, and I think it's possible that they could extend his deal. I'm not sure. I can't say with any certainty it will happen, though, because like so many of these other players, the Saints are under no incentive really to do this. They're going to have a chance to let him play out this contract, see what he can do. So Pierre Thomas is in a little bit better situation than Ronnie Brown. He's younger, broader outlook there, but still not a done deal.
Well, Dan, you mentioned no incentive for the Saints to do anything with Pierre Thomas. They do have to at least give him a contract since he is a free agent, even though he's restricted. But in New York, one of the most difficult stories of all for the Jets, Darrell Revis is under contract. That's not the issue. He's still got a rookie contract that he's not happy with, now that many people believe he is the best cornerback in all of football. And this has gotten sometimes acrimonious between him and the ball club. There was an incident a week ago at a mini camp or in an OTA where he showed up for practice and then chose to sit out part of the practice, claiming to be lightheaded. Apparently he and Rex Ryan have sat down and talked it through. But you got to believe that this one, for a team that many people are picking to win the AFC, is going to be an ongoing distraction and that something has to give here.
Unlike some of these other players we've been talking about, Darrell Revis has 3 years left on his deal. So that's a little bit of a unique circumstance in this case. I think that there's a report out today that says the Jets are willing, they're interested in extending that deal and making him, give him the highest contract ever for a defensive back, you know, possibly in about around $100 million. It's going to average about $12 million per season, which is not as much as Nnamdi Asamoah is making per season. That's kind of what Darrell Revis has been looking at in terms of contract that he wants. So whether he's willing to budge and say, you know what, this is, in the long term I'm going to be making a great amount of money, and I'm not going to be getting paid as high annually as Nnamdi Asamoah, but I'm still going to be the highest paid defensive back in league history. It's a pretty good deal. Whether he takes it or not remains to be seen. He's been pretty stubborn so far. He said he was insulted with the Jets' first offer, so we'll see where this goes. But I think I don't think a deal is imminent here.
Oh, you love these kids who are insulted by their $60, $70 million offers. We've got more NFL Way We Hear It coming up in just a moment. Bob Arkish and Mike Wilkening. We've got more NFL Way We Hear It. We're going to talk about one of Wilkie's ball clubs right now that didn't have a particularly good week. They haven't had a particularly good June so far. You know, Mike, the Tennessee Titans probably glad that they're done with Albert Haynesworth, even though they lost his production quite a bit. But they got some new contract issues of their own. Running back Chris Johnson became the sixth man in NFL history to rush for over 2,000 yards in a season last year. He wants to get paid. He's in just the third year of his rookie contract that is slated to pay him $550,000. And yet the Titans are saying, no, you've got a contract. And Johnson seems to be trying hard not to let this get acrimonious, but something's going to have to give here, because I think even the cold-hearted, the most cold-hearted amongst us would say this kid should get more than $550,000.
Well, Hub, I think you've hit it right on the head in terms of the impasse that these sides are at this point. Johnson had his football camp this week and told the Nashville Tennessean, quote, I can't play for $550,000. So one of his strongest statements yet in terms of his contract situation indicated a holdout could be possible if he didn't get a new deal. Again, 3 years left on his deal. The Titans have indicated that, you know, that really at this point it might not be in the cards to get a new deal for him. Obviously, one of the restrictions the Titans are facing here, as is every team in terms of structuring new contracts, is this 30% rule in terms of the inability of a player to get more than a 30% raise over his previous year's salary in a new contract here in the uncapped year. So it's an issue the Titans face with Johnson. It's certainly one I think that makes things difficult, because obviously the amount of guaranteed money Chris Johnson would have to get in a new deal would have to make up for that. It's very clear, Hub, and I think you got this completely correct, that he deserves a new deal. You know, there's certainly a case for him to make some more money. He's very, very productive. He's the heart and soul of that offense. Whether or not both sides can come together on this, I think, is one of these storylines to watch here in the NFL as this offseason progresses.
All right, Mike. And Vince Young, I am still not in any way convinced that this guy's ever going to be a big-time NFL quarterback. I just don't think he's a great passer. But all he does is win. He got the starting job back last year and led the Titans on their big second half surge. Unfortunately, when it seemed like he really cemented himself as the Titans quarterback now, he gets into a fight in a Dallas strip club. And this opens up all kinds of questions as to, A, why are these kids putting themselves in these positions in the first place? Two, what happened? Was he out of control? He was charged with basically a Class C misdemeanor. It's a $500 fine. It's not viewed as anything terribly serious. There is videotape of it, and yet Roger Goodell has said he has to take a look at it. The league office will investigate, and Young has very publicly, A, apologized, taken responsibility, and B, practically pleaded with the commissioner not to suspend him.
Right. You know, isn't that something? This is kind of the era in terms of, with the personal conduct being strengthened the way it is, it was very interesting that Vince Young, one of the things he said was, quote, "I pray to God that Roger Goodell doesn't come down hard on me, because I definitely want to be here for my teammates," he said on Monday. And I think that maybe a suspension isn't in the cards here necessarily. He has not violated the personal conduct policy before. A minor incident on balance, but taking this into context, Vince Young, as quarterback, you try to be the leader of that offense, is somebody that the Titans are paying a lot of money. There have been sort of questions about, you know, just his maturity in terms of growing up and all those things. This is an unpleasant thing. This is not something definitely that you know, a hurdle he's kind of placed in front of himself here that he's got to have to overcome. I think it is something that can be overcome, but here's the thing. Obviously, it's not a great thing. The timing is not good, and certainly, all things considered, not a news story I think the Titans wanted to see this week.
All right, we have got to take another quick commercial break here, but we've still got more coming for you. The Publisher's Pen is up on the other side.
The Publisher's Pen, with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish.
Mike, thank you very much, and we're going to keep it real short and sweet this week, because I just want to take my hat off and congratulate both the world champion L.A. Lakers and the Boston Celtics on an outstanding seven-game NBA final series. You know, you look at what went on, and bottom line is the Lakers are the champs, but not much really separated these two clubs. What will be interesting going forward, though, is what happens to the Boston Celtics. Ray Allen is a free agent. Kevin Garnett and Paul Pierce have been around for a while. We don't know if this team can make one more run with the age and the free agency questions. For the LA Lakers, everything's intact, guys. We could be looking at a dynasty, another Laker run. Be very interested to see what Phil Jackson does next. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News. Our thanks to Steve Kyler of HoopsWorld.com. Randy Meyer, such a great job at Syndication Networks. And most of all, thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week, same time, same station, on Pro Football Weekly and Basketball News.